This is Sam Sherman, president of Independent International Pictures Corp. and producer of Dracula vs. Frankenstein, and I'm going to give you some background on the music score for this film. I will start by saying I'm a longtime movie fan. I'm a movie buff. I'm a collector. I'm a follower of everything going back to the silent era. Not that I go back to it, but my interest in movies from the teens and 20s straight through to the 50s. And that's kind of a classic era that I'm interested in. One of my great interests was background music scoring. And I used to collect soundtrack albums, audio tapes, tape music scores from main titles and films from television back in the 1950s when I was a kid. And I just loved music scoring, especially for horror pictures, Western serials, things of that nature. And after seeing many, many films, I got to figure out who my favorite composers were, and my top all-time favorite was William Lava, or Bill Lava as he was called, who started out in the 1930s, first at RKO, and then he went to Republic Pictures, and his first major piece of music was the main title and the foreword to the 1937 serial The Painted Stallion, starring Ray Crash Corrigan. And it was such a great piece of music that it was put into the Republic Pictures music library and used over and over again in many of their serials and westerns, and got to be a favorite. And he began writing music for their library and for individual films, and especially the beginning of the John Wayne series of Three Musketeers westerns, where he actually started that score for that series in the prior series, the end of the Bob Livingston, Ray Corrigan, Max Terhune series called Heroes of the Hills, had the music that was generally used in the John Wayne Three Musketeers series, eight pictures of that group. Then he got involved with writing music for serials, and my favorite of his music for serials is the 1939 serial Daredevils of the Red Circle. Just incredibly great music by any measure, and he wrote for a lot of the dramatic feature films as well as the serials and westerns. And eventually I felt I wanted to get in touch with him, and I contacted him. He lived in North Hollywood in Los Angeles, and when I was out there, I got to meet him, and he took me out to lunch at Musso and Frank, a beautiful old-time restaurant. I say old-time, from the classic era, on Hollywood Boulevard, and with us was another young man by the name of Jim King, unfortunately now gone, as is Bill Lava. And Jim King had worked with Bill Lava. He was a fan like myself, but he also had music ability, and he worked with Bill Lava at Disney and I think at Warner Brothers. So I was a great fan of his and got to be a friend of his. When this movie that became known as Dracula vs. Frankenstein came up, and it was being called Blood of Frankenstein at that time, about the middle of 1970, and I was in Los Angeles working on the filming and the editing, and I asked him if he would be interested in doing the music score, and I said we were on a very low budget, and he agreed to do it with a small orchestra. That orchestra was only actually 13 pieces. Hard to believe, but 13 pieces. I sent him a quarter-inch recording of a music score I really liked, which was Tito Aravallo's score for the Hemisphere picture Mad Doctor of Blood Island, which I had worked on, and I had the original soundtrack score, and sent him a copy of it. And I tried to tell him the type of a horror score I wanted. It must have tubas in it. It must have low notes. It must be ponderous if it has a monster in it. Vroom, 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 that kind of thing. And I felt he really didn't adapt too much from Mad Doctor of Blood Island, but it's possible if you analyze the two, there may be something he picked up from it. So he did the score, and the film was edited in Los Angeles. The score was then transferred from magnetic track to film magnetic track, and the editors out there edited that music together into the picture where Bill Lava had decided music should go. So he was not only the composer, but he also was the musical director of the movie. He was deciding where the music was and told them where to put it in. Well, he mixed the picture together and sent me a copy of it. I thought it was horrible. I didn't like the film to begin with, but I thought it was horrible the way the music was utilized in most cases. and it was so bassy that you couldn't hear any brilliance to it at all. I really didn't like it. I decided, based on there being problems for the film, to shelve the film, and it was shelved for at least a year, during which those problems were solved, and we decided to reshoot the ending and call the film Dracula vs. Frankenstein, which had the fight of the two monsters. But by that time, Bill Lava had passed away, and we were kind of stuck with the music that had been recorded. And since there was so much new footage added, I was very concerned about reusing the same music over and over again. It's something that always bothered me. And I decided also I wanted to finish the film in New York. So the picture editing was finished in Los Angeles and the sound effects editing. And the film was sent back to me to New York City. And I, being a music fan, I also had the opportunity early in my career as a film editor to work in the music scoring and music editing business. So I had that background. And when I decided to do this, I had the original multi-track recording of the score for Blood of Frankenstein sent to me. I took it to a studio and I listened to everything on every track. And then I decided how I would remix it. I wouldn't use the mix that Bill Lava had done. It was too bassy and lacked any brilliance. And I remixed it with an engineer in a studio, so it was bright and sharp and powerful, added some reverb, did a lot of things with it. But I was also concerned, as I was going to be selecting the music and editing, that some of the music was not a continuous type of strong horror, agitato, powerful, and it would be very powerful and horrific and exciting, and then it would go down, it would go boom, 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 boom. And then that would go down, then it would come up powerfully. Well, I knew that in Hollywood they did that in big films and small films, cut out the low parts. So I took several of the more powerful cues and cut them together into several cues that I called the re-edited cues, so I could easily have access to them when I was editing the film together, the music for the film together, and it would all be of one type. It would continue powerfully, and I try to make clean cuts. And it was kind of similar to what I did using some of those multi-track cues or multi-composite cues into the main titles, and I also did some other edits in that. I felt we needed more music in the film, and so I searched around, and through my contact with Ego Cantor, famous producer, music director, I was able to get in touch with Harry Lubin and license from him some of his music, and through him from Joe Gershenson, the former musical director of Universal Pictures, some of the music that he owned from Universal Pictures that had been used in their horror films of the 50s, including Creature from the Black Lagoon. This gave me a composite score of the Bill Lava music, which is most identified with the film, plus the other Universal music and some music from Harry Lubin, plus some songs. So that was quite a musical movie, if you think about it. Bill Lava's background was Republic Pictures, near and dear to my heart, and loved all those movies. And then he went to RKO again. Then he was at Warner's. He did a lot of pictures for them. He also ghosted scores for Max Steiner, writing in Steiner Scott style. And I should mention, when he was at Republic, he kind of invented a style of scoring for Western movies that continues to this day, even mimicked later by the great composer Victor Young, and then mimicked also by others like Paul Sautel. So he created a style for Western movies that was just exciting, expansive. It felt it was action music and panoramic music for the West, some of the best scoring ever done for Western movies. And in the later years, he went to Disney and so on and so forth. He's very well known for cartoons at Warner Brothers, including the Roadrunner series and the Warner Brothers television series F-Troop. But his work goes all over the place. His last job that he did before he passed away was some kind of an FBI TV show with David Janssen. But his last feature score is definitely Dracula vs. Frankenstein. So I was telling about how I created the composite cues, I edited together all the music in the picture, the Bill Lava music, and then most of the Universal music towards the end of the film. And also there were some cues from Paul Sautel and Bert Schefter used that also came through Ego Cantor. And those were, I believe, from a film called Kronos, or Kronos, and there must have been some others there. And I consider it a great privilege and honor to have had a friend of the quality of William Lava, and also the fact that he just did such a wonderful job for me on this movie. But the main thing was that here was I, a kid from the Bronx who wanted to be in the industry, getting a chance to go to Hollywood and work with my favorite composer, a great kind of a legend of Hollywood's big studio movies. He did the score for me. People are listening to it and remembering it, and I want to keep that memory alive of the great work of William Lava. I'd like to speak to you now about my creating and working on radio spot commercials for motion pictures. How I got into this is very unusual, because it's not what I wanted to do, but I was a film editor and a music and sound editor, and also a writer, and having all these skills, they kind of came to a point at one place, and that was advertising materials for movies. And this came about because I needed to make a trailer for the reissue of the 1934 Scarlet Letter that I was going to distribute with the cooperation and work of Victor Adamson Productions, as headed by Al Adamson's father, Denver Dixon. So we did that before I ever did anything with Al, or before Al did much in the industry. So I needed a trailer to put out with the film, and I couldn't have a budget to go to National Screen Service that made great trailers. So I made it myself, and again, a lot of the things I did and still do in the industry is based on being a fan and a movie buff and studying things of similar nature. So I was a collector and a student of movie trailers. I always liked them. It gave me an opportunity to come up with kind of an exploitive version of a trailer for The Scarlet Letter, which is rather funny because while I made it kind of lurid, playing up the infidelity and all the lurid aspects of The Scarlet Letter, the film ended up being released theatrically and playing on the classic level for schools, and they were bussing the children in. So I don't know what the teachers thought if those trailers were run the week before. I never figured that out. It was later on, when I was doing work for Hemisphere Pictures, that they had been using National Screen Service and other people to make trailers, radio, and TV spots. And they knew I was an editor and I could do this and a writer. And they asked me if I could possibly do that for them. And so I ended up being in charge of a lot of their marketing, writing the copy, engaging the narrator, directing him in a recording session, then editing it together with music and sound effects and putting a trailer together with special trailer titles and everything. Well, I quickly learned, especially based on Hemisphere Pictures having such low budgets, that there had to be a way of doing the trailer and radio and television spots all at the same time. So I didn't write precise copy in many cases to fit necessarily the running time, but I tended to overwrite and give me a lot of over narration that I could cut up. And I did a trailer for them for a movie called Sex is a Woman, which was actually a British movie called Love is a Woman. It wasn't very sexy or filled with love, but it was how they wanted to exploit it. And around that time, I had produced a trailer for Erwin Peiser's other company, Teledynamics Corp., for a war film called Mission to Death. And for that trailer, I used Stan Martin, who was a radio announcer. So we had Stan Martin do both of those trailers, Mission to Death and Love is a Woman or Sex is a Woman. And he did other work for me. But as I was to go on in the field, I had Erwin Peiser at Hemisphere, who offered his critique, and he wanted something strange and different, so I had Brother Theodore do a very strange trailer for me, and that also served as the recording for the radio and the TV spots. And when I started Independent International Pictures, I used Brother Theodore. Another man who came through Joe Franklin was a great Shakespearean actor and Gilbert and Sullivan star on the stage by the name of Lloyd Harris. And he did deep horror kind of things like that. Erwin Peiser liked him. And so I used him in some of the things for our company. But it was again through Joe Franklin that he found Rick Wayne, who tended to be more announcer-like. And he tended to do most of the trailers and radio TV spots at Independent International, somebody once calling him the voice of Independent International. As a matter of fact, I received a phone call once some years ago by, I think they were called Don and Mike or some name like that. It was a radio show from Washington, D.C., and they patched me in live, and they asked me if I had produced these radio spots, and they played them on the air. Well, they were so fascinated by the craziness of the over-the-top approach I used that they were laughing as they were playing them, and they were interviewing me, and they eventually tracked down Rick Wayne and did a whole program with Rick Wayne and myself running these spots. Some of them were exclusively written as radio spots, and where I used to do all the editing when I started Independent International, my late partner Dan Kenneth said, well, you can't do everything. You can't be marketing and traveling and working on production with Al Adamson and doing all this and editing all this stuff. So we hired a young filmmaker by the name of Steve Jacobson, who came in and worked very well with me, and he did the editing of the radio spots, TV spots, and the trailers, and he knew how to work with me. So what I would do is I'd write the copy, I'd hire the announcer or the narrator, go into a studio, coach him as to how I wanted it read. I would read it once, then I'd have him do it, and if he flubbed, he'd do it again and again, but I didn't just stay on his back continuously telling him how to do it. I let him have some range, providing he was giving me what I wanted. There may be a few here that I didn't do. I think we may have reused some old ones that came from Saxton Films on Island of Lost Girls, but it's possible it's something we did. I guess most of them we did. The main thing is that they're from an era of drive-in movies where hokey over-the-top spots were very big. There were some even crazier ones done by other people. In the South, they'd use radio announcers, and they'd go crazy with reverb. And he's coming, and it's horrible, on a triple bill, you see, monsters, blah, blah, blah. And it was the same thing that they were using for selling used cars or a visit to a snack bar or a rock and roll show. Crazy radio effects, that was a special thing. And as a matter of fact, Belton Clark at Clark Films in Jacksonville used to do his own radio spots for us because he knew his market better, and the stock ones we did, he didn't necessarily like. And any of these guys coming in and doing all these crazy effects, maybe two guys talking, it'll be this, you'll got to see it now. It'll be that, you got to see it now. It's horror, 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 horror. And it would be all that kind of thing. I don't know. I was corny, and I try to be a good marketing guy for drive-ins in the South and the Midwest. But some of these over-the-top spots, I felt they kind of blended in with the DJ shows, and they didn't really sell the movie as well. I was interested in getting across the name of the film. An announcer came in later and said where it was playing, and I would try to have some mood. So many dead bodies were put together, and this happened, and that happened. Kind of seduce the audience into the fact that this even was a movie, not just more DJs yelling with more reverb. Well, anyway, Sam Sherman saying, listen, listen, listen to the radio spot, spot, spot.